This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivisodhi. Sue Jennings in the studio. She's a play and drama therapist. And today we're going to be discussing something really interesting. It's called neurodramatic play. It's a sort of therapy for children, play therapy. It brings about a whole load of other issues to the fore as well in addressing children's issues. And if you have a question for Sue, send it through via text message. It's 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio. Welcome to the show, Sue. How are you today?
Thank you.
Sue, could you just give me a little bit of a background of how you got involved in this? And neurodrama play is something that, you know, you're very fond of. What is it actually?
Well, it's really grown out of my professional practice with children with special needs, children with emotional difficulties, looking at the very early development and what might be missing. And, of course, we've had a lot of advances in neuroscience as well. So we understand a lot more about what happens in a child's brain when they're born. And if there are certain things missing, such as a lot of sensory play, a lot of physical contact, a lot of rhythmic play, which are usual interactions between mothers and babies, if those are missed out on, we find it actually affects the development of the brain.
If this is part of neuroscience, how did we move away from engaging and being involved in these little things?
Well, neuroscience is really a very new science when you look at it alongside other sciences. And it was when the neglect that was going on in the orphanages in Eastern Europe that gave a lot of material for the neuroscientists to be actually examining. And they found conclusively that children that were not nurtured or cared for or looked after, when they looked at x-rays of their brains, the whole areas that had not developed, particularly in the neocortex, which are obviously to do with higher thinking and to do with what comes after the basic learning in the brain when a child is born. So the nurture affects higher order thinking. It was as simple as that. And there were these black areas in the brains. So what several of us started to do was to look at, well, what can we do to make up the deficit of play? Not just any old play, because parents might say to me, oh, yes, but he plays on his computer, he's got a Game Boy, he plays in the garden. That's not the same as a play that forms a relationship, which is interactive. And we find it's this interactive play, using the senses initially, using rhythm, using heartbeats, for example, all build up this playful relationship. Now, if there's security there, the child is developing confidence, they're developing empathy, and soon they will develop resilience.
Just to go back to the orphanage, and, you know, they were lacking as you said, they were lacking something. And you said that affected how they developed, right? Are you saying that now we are also neglecting our children to a certain extent?
Well, I think society, all countries, have so much pressure on them to be dual earners, for example, in the family. There are a lot of private childminders, a lot of nurseries and so on, that something has got forgotten in all this. I mean, whereas very, very early on in the last century, if you couldn't care for your child directly, then you had a wet nurse. But the wet nurse gave undivided care and breastfeeding to a small child, right? But I think in more recent times, we've somehow bypassed that very sensory, physical early development. And again, parents are very keen, obviously, on their children succeeding and expect academic learning to happen much earlier. Private tutors at the age of 3 and 4. Whereas what we still need to get across through NDP, neurodramatic play, is that the early playful relationship will actually encourage academic learning later. You can't avoid that stage.
Earlier on in your career, you observed the developmental progression in young children, and you described it as the embodiment progression role, something called EPR. Could you elaborate more on that and how that understanding has evolved in child development since then?
Yes. I mean, initially, I was doing all my research with children after they were born and looking at that physical relationship in the first year and how children moved on from the purely physical to life outside the body, which we call the projective stage. And then 18 months or so later, they began to start playing roles. You know, instead of talking about a character or playing, say, with the doll's house with little figures, they would be the figures. They would be the monster and the mum and the dad. And children are very good at playing lots of roles at the same time. They're not like grown-ups who say, well, you be this and I'll be that. Kids will do it all together, which is wonderful. So that was my first focus, which we call the EPR development. But what emerged for me was I completely overlooked looking at before that. What happens during pregnancy? What happens during the birth itself? And what happens in the first 6 months? So I was going back in age stages. And it was really very interesting interviewing pregnant women who would talk to their child, who would massage, who would tell the unborn child stories. And very often they were a bit embarrassed and didn't want to tell me about it till I actually said how important it was. Again, we can be encouraging mothers at antenatal clinics to have a creative, interactive relationship with their unborn child.
But there's nothing to say that even if you don't, the child's development is going to be affected?
Well, certainly, for example, we know scientifically that if you play certain music during pregnancy, the baby recognizes the music when they're born. We know that. We know that a baby will recognize the mother's voice because before they're born, the womb acts like an amplifier. And so the baby's actually hearing the mother's voice very loud. And when the baby's born, they will look around the room trying to find the mother's voice within hours of being born, sometimes within minutes. And the first thing we observe when the baby's born is if mother holds them in front of them, the baby tries to imitate the expression on the mother's face.
Really?
Within maximum 4 hours of being born, that will happen.
I didn't check. I didn't keep an eye.
So you're actually getting interactive drama, imitation going on within hours of being born. So I really got into the dramatic interaction. So I started with a dramatic interaction and worked back with heartbeats and rhythm. And a colleague of mine, I must just tell you, is doing research with children on the autistic spectrum, using Shakespeare, because she's realised that Shakespeare's rhythm, the verse, mirrors the human heartbeat. Ti-tum, 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 ti-tum. And she's doing amazing research, both in England and in the States. I couldn't believe it when I went to one of her workshops and saw children on the spectrum getting involved, even if they were nonverbal, with the imagery and the rhythm of Shakespeare.
Who do you work with most? Do you work with children who have special needs or who are on the autism spectrum? Mm. Are they the ones who benefit most from neurodramatically?
Not only. It's also really important for children with behaviour difficulties because obviously the earlier you can start addressing behaviour difficulties, the better. If you leave it till teens, it gets more difficult. Children with emotional difficulties, children with attachment issues where there hasn't been a clear bonding with parents and so on. So because I'm pioneering neurodramatic play, I try to work right across the difficulty range as possible. And I try to do as much training as I can in neurodramatic play, which is why I'm doing the workshops in Kuala Lumpur, so that as many people as possible, whether it's parents or teachers or carers or nannies, whoever, get exposed to that.
When you talk about children with attachment problems, how early do you intervene? Because sometimes it just can be a phase that they would get over. So when do you realize that it is actually a problem and you know you need some kind of help?
Well, often I'll get a parent coming to me and saying, you know, I'm struggling. I was struggling to actually have a relationship with my baby. Sometimes they hadn't wanted the baby, and sometimes they've been left on their own to cope. Sometimes they got a conflict between career and baby. So very often it is the parent, and I think it's very important that I reassure the parent that we can do something about this. I'm not there to criticise or undermine parents in any way at all. Parenting in the modern world is not easy. I mean, you're exposed to so many different things, so many commercial pressures. Do this for your baby, buy that for your baby. You're a good parent if you use disinfectant, baby wipes. Baby wipes are the bane of my life.
Why
they
is
really
that?
They really are. Because it means parents get into a spin that their baby must not be messy. Children need mess. Children who play in sand or dirt develop an immune system. Children who play with mess learn about order. So one thing I do with all my trainees to start with is they do messy play with flour and water and get it all sticking to their fingers. And then out of that, they learn from mess to order. And that's a child's normal development. You don't need the wet wipes. You need things to play with, you know, whether it's water, sand and water, clay, plasticine, whatever you like. We all need to make a mess. Now, when children work with me in therapy, I find that some children will spend a long time with messy play, and it's usually an indication that it's somehow connected that their lives are very messy too, or that inside they're feeling very messy. But using the messy play and having permission to make chaos, slowly they will get through and come out the other side. It's such a crucial way of working, and I have to keep reminding people mess is okay, you know.
And we're discussing neurodramatic play. When we come back, I want to find out more about whether or not, as Sue just mentioned, it is early intervention is always the best, but is it ever too late to introduce neurodramatic play in early adolescents and maybe even adults? Mm-hmm. How do we use this play to, you know, get us going, fixing problems? That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasuthi. Sue Jennings, a play and drama therapist in the studio with us. We're trying to understand neurodramatic play, which is something Sue is a huge advocate of, you know, and here in Malaysia, running a workshop. Workshops happening on the 3rd and 10th of October, Sue?
That's right, yes.
Okay. And what is it about, the two workshops? Would you like to shed more light on the workshops?
Yes, well, the two workshops are very specific aspects of neurodramatic play. The first one is on emotional intelligence, because it's relatively recently that we've realised that it's not all about IQ, that if children have a disrupted emotional life that is with some developmental delay, it actually will stop them learning their IQ levels. So the first workshop will be looking at, well, how can we help a child who's got developmental delay deal with emotional issues and move on, so that their emotional intelligence is for an appropriate age.
All of which using neurodramatic play.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I'll just give a little example. I worked intensively with a group of seven children in the UK, aged between chronological age 8 and 11. And when we observed them playing, they were playing like 2-year-olds, not like 9, 10, 11-year-olds, and we realised that emotionally they had just not caught up. So we were able to actually work with that using the messy play, the rhythmic play and the dramatic play. And even after 7 days of very intensive work, we had a noticeable improvement. They were catching up with their IQ. So that's a general example. It works.
I think identifying the problem is the first step, Sue. And sometimes it's a grey area. You're not sure whether it's a problem or not. How do you move from there? How do you become aware that your child is maybe emotionally not up to the mark as she should be? How do you decide that?
Well, Often we assess it through the way the child plays. Normally when I see children, I have them for a couple of sessions just diagnostically to allow them to play, and you see what they avoid and what they play with, what they want to do, what they don't want to do, the things they choose. And just to give a little example of one boy who, his life was just chaotic. Just chaotic. He didn't know where he was. He didn't know who was mum, etc. And he always chose the sand tray to play in. So I have a big sand tray. And normally children will play in the sand or put little figures in it. No. He climbed in it and poured a bucket of water over himself and splashed around in sand and water. Well, the books don't tell you what to do when that happens.
No.
I thought, I'll just follow this child.
Yeah.
And for weeks, he came, tipped the water, because I had to keep spare clothes there, so he went home in dry clothes. He played real whole-body messy play. And then it changed. And he didn't want to get in it at all. He wanted to play in it. And he didn't want it soaking wet. He just wanted to mould, and he made tunnels. And you see? And then a few weeks later, he started using the little figures, telling a narrative. So can you see developmentally,
yes,
he went through real personal messy play into playing with the sand and moving on to be able to create a narrative. Now, he took himself through that journey. I didn't have to tell him things. He knew where he needed to go with the NDP. And it was quite extraordinary how he came out of the other end, far less chaotic, and having, I think, quite a sense of his own identity. Because once he'd started playing with the figures, he was beginning to be able to tell little stories and so on. You know, he was not quite seven. And in time, I think, for him, he was able to make, you know, that big milestone.
Is it ever too late to
practice
neurodramatic?
An eternal optimist. My oldest person I've ever done NDP with was 101.
Wow.
She was in a care home and she had dementia, and I ran a whole NDP program in the care home, and she was extraordinary. When she was playing, she got out of her dementia and she wanted to do sand play, although usually it's children that want to, but no, she wanted to do sand play. She wanted shells, she wanted stones, she wanted special little jewels and things to create pictures. She wanted to play with the puppets. She wanted to draw pictures. I mean, she was an amazing woman. And that just really brought it home to me. You are never too old to play, and you're never too old to actually be helped with neurodramatic play.
What about people with Alzheimer's?
Well, again, I've worked with so many people, older people in care homes, and also with people with Alzheimer's at home, where I've been asked to go in and do something creative. That we write off people too quickly. You can get underneath the Alzheimer's. I'm not saying that play cures physically anything, because we're talking about an organic disease. But you can go underneath it to find other parts of the self that are lucid, that can play, that do make sense. And for them, it's very reassuring, because it's very distressing. And most people know there's something wrong. They know they've got Alzheimer's. And for them to see that they're being validated through this type of work is very reassuring. And most of them have had some artistic interest early on in their lives anyway. They're either very musical. There was one professional musician in one of my groups, and she was really quite upset when the only music in the care home was sort of Muzak being played all the time, and she was a classical opera singer. Now, when she could actually listen to opera, and a friend of mine who was a pianist played for her, and she was able to sing along a little bit some of her old operas. Amazing. She just was transformed, you see. And I think what we have to keep asking ourselves all the time is about well-being. How can people feel reasonably okay with themselves and their lives? You see, people are very critical, for example, of teenagers. And as you know, my second workshop is about anger management. And so many parents, teachers come to me and say, so-and-so is so angry and they're lashing out or they're breaking or they're doing this, that and the other. A child who, or teenager who is very angry, it's not happy they're angry, they're scared. And if you go underneath almost all anger, you find fear. So anger is much more a coping mechanism for fear than something in itself. We react when we're frightened. So being able to help people look at management strategies when people are angry, because the worst thing you can do if somebody loses it is to send the child to their bedroom, because they're then isolated with these feelings that have got out of control. But if you can give the child a really strong hug and hold that anger, and I've seen it work time and time and time again, big hug, less anger, because they've suddenly got boundaries again. They're being contained and held. Time to find out why the anger later. No one who is angry can explain their anger. It all needs to calm. And it's not calmed by sending teenagers off to their bedrooms. It just doesn't work.
Does culture play a role in how successful neurodramatic play is?
To a certain extent, yes. I mean, for example, when I was doing my research with Jorang Astley, they are very much a non-violent people. So I wasn't learning about anger issues. I was learning from them about nurture and child rearing. And I, how shall I say, my whole attitude towards child rearing children and the life cycle changed after living for a year and a half with Jorang Astley. I was doing my doctoral research. I took my own children and we lived actually in the rainforest for 18 months. And we came back different people, all of us, there's no doubt about that. Because to see that one could live a life that was not violent, that violence didn't have to be a means of intervention, to live a life that's based on giving, because Jorang Astley, certainly the group I worked with, that's the Temiar tribe, they believe that if somebody asks you for something, you have to give it. Otherwise, bad luck comes on the person who asked, not on you, but the person who asked. So nobody wants to be responsible for somebody having bad luck. But they never ask for anything unreasonably. You know, if you had some extra rice, they would ask you for half of it. They would never ask you for all of it. Yes. So generosity was something really important that we learned from the Jorang Astley.
What came through in the child rearing side of things that you learned from the Jorang Astley?
Well, first of all, the children don't have a role model of violent behaviour. Their children aren't smacked and hit. They don't see parents hitting each other. So the role modelling of care and nurture and the role model of sharing and giving is what the child has from birth. Because children go everywhere. They're carried in slings, either in front to start with, on the back later. And so all the time they're surrounded by the ethos of the non-violence, the nurture, the giving. And of course, they breastfeed much longer than non-Jorang Astley groups by and large. I mean, there's a huge return to breastfeeding long-term in England, that you don't necessarily wean one child before the next one comes along. You can actually co-feed, and then there's no jealousy between the children. But the Jorang Astley generally breastfeed to 3 or 4 years. And interestingly, their children usually walk much earlier. So we were witnessing children walking by 10, 11 months old. So the feeding didn't make them more dependent. It actually, interestingly, made them more independent.
That's very interesting.
Very interesting. I'm trying to find some doctors here in Malaysia that would help do some medical research.
Yes, to explain the signs behind
it. The other thing is the lack of disability. In all the time that I was going and living with the Jorang Astley, we never, ever met a child with a disability of any kind. A couple of years ago, I went on a visit and we witnessed one child who probably had cerebral palsy. They hadn't actually been told at the hospital, but it seemed there was a lack of oxygen at birth. So why is that? Isn't that an important thing for us to find out from the RAF? The other thing I learned so much about was their playing, how the children play. They play out adult roles, they play out situations that have happened, they play out their fears. They're always playing but learning. And that is so important. They taught me how important play is.
But when does learning come into being?
Well, I think, generally speaking, the RNIC children mature physically and emotionally sooner than their counterparts. They're physically extremely strong because they have to live in a hostile environment, dealing with nature, dealing, obviously, with man-made disasters as well, which is, as we all know, a huge political issue with the Orangasti.
Yes.
But so they are living in a hostile environment on several levels. But one thing, and certainly we became much fitter, they are physically, overall, very fit. And we became physically very strong while we were there, which was really quite interesting. It made an impact on us too.
And where does neurodramatically fall in the whole spectrum of psychological therapy? I mean, you have counsellors, you have psychologists, you have psychiatrists. Where does this actually sit?
Okay. Well, neurodramatic play can belong to any of those disciplines. Counsellors, psychologists, psychiatrists all come on my training courses and integrate it in terms of how they work. The part of it that's very different from how most of those people work is that we place so much importance on the nonverbal, whereas counselling, for example, psychotherapy, psychodrama, all these things are very verbal methods. We are both nonverbal and also preverbal, and that's a very important dimension. We make use of creative techniques, we make use of play toys, we make use of drama things, masks, we make use of music, costumes, you name it, we can use it. So that's the difference. When you're talking about play and drama therapy, it is the intrinsic value of the drama itself that is therapeutic. It's the intrinsic value of play itself that is therapeutic. That's a difference. So whereas a counsellor might make use of drama as a technique, then their attention is not on what is therapeutic in itself about the drama. I'm not evaluating one as being better than another. I'm saying that they're different. And together they address different issues. They complement each other. They don't compete with each other.
And for adults, for an example, how do we indulge in neurodramatic play? Can we do this ourselves at home? I mean, considering the stressful life that everybody leads today?
I think NDP and EPR really are helpful to grown-ups. Grown-ups have forgotten how to play. They really need to relearn that.
I like your badge. It says, keep calm and be playful.
Absolutely. That's
to
my motto.
Everyone.
That's my motto.
Yeah.
And we're so busy in the competitive world out there, forgetting that if we have time off to play, we actually perform better. You see it in secondary school when children are coming up to GCSE exams, A-levels. They cut the drama, the music lessons, focus on revision and learning. Whereas the reverse should be true. There should be more art, which takes the pressure off the brain learning. You know, we've got two halves of our brains, for goodness sake. We've got two hemispheres, and one hemisphere is very much to do with learning, rote learning, mathematics and science. But the other hemisphere is to do with creativity, and it's to do with inspiration. Now, a lot of the time, what children need in their exams is inspiration. Why stop developing that side of the brain? Inspiration, intuition. The right hemisphere is also, how do you form a hypothesis? Now, that's a very scientific-sounding thing.
It is.
But it doesn't belong to your left hemisphere. It belongs to your right hemisphere. Creating a hypothesis first, then validating it with your left hemisphere. So we need those two parts of the brain to be both developed together, or one outweighs the other.
Terribly powerful, I have to say. Absolutely. Sue Jennings is actually going to be having workshops on the 3rd of October on emotional intelligence and anger management on the 10th of October. So this will be held at Help International, in Damansara Heights, am I correct?
Yes, Wismar Help.
Wismar Help. Yes. And if you'd like more information, we have a phone number here. Get in touch with Margaret C. The phone number is 03-2711-2000. 2711-2000 or email Margaret at margaret.sie@help.edu.my. It was a pleasure having you on, Sue.
Thank you so much.
Would you like to leave us with a message on neurodramatic play?
Keep playing. Allow a bit of mess. Play a rhythm. And you'll be fine.
Sue Jennings, a play and drama therapist on Neurodramatic Play on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.